quest doesn't have much information about this course, and it doesn't even reveal where it is. So I'm very glad that you made it here. I wonder how you found out. Did you just Google it? Probably, right? Yeah, very good. So what I would recommend is, if you haven't found it yet, to find the homepage here. There it is. Right, my homepage. And then from my homepage, if you click on teaching, general relativity for cosmology, and there you will find a website which has plenty of information about this course, and I keep it up to date. So I thought, let's start by going through this site, and I just show you what the general logistics is going to be. So it's going to be Tuesdays and Fridays in this room, except for in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, it'll be at 1 p.m. So the Friday in 2 weeks from now will be at 1 p.m. I don't know the room yet. Maybe we'll get this room, maybe another one. I will post it on this site. I will also send an email around. That's one of the reasons why there's the sign-up sheet so that I can communicate efficiently. Because not everybody will be officially enrolled, so just to make sure I have everybody's email address, please sign up there. This course, just to start with the logistics of it, will not have a midterm. It will not have a final exam. But there's going to be an essay and a project. And the details of the essay and the project are already explained on this page. What's expected, it's about 10 pages for the essay, 10 pages for the project. And the topics and all of those things are already explained there. At the moment, I would like to postpone that, have a look if you're already interested in this, but there might still be a few changes to exactly the definition of the project and the essay. But it's already fairly complete, the information that you will find there. So the essay and the project are due at the end of the term, sometime in December. Now, the content of the course, that's weird. This has a delay of a second or so. The content of the course also listed here already. But let me just give you the general overview. It'll have three parts. The first part is mathematical background, differential geometry. The second part is going to be general relativity. And the third part is going to be cosmology. So in the first part, which we will start today, we will do the mathematical background needed for general relativity. We will start with the very basics, but then we will go very steeply to rather sophisticated methods. Methods that are powerful for use in black hole physics or in cosmology or in quantum gravity. So after we've done the math of that, then we do general relativity. And we will study general relativity in its various formulations, also as a gauge theory, and various properties of it in general. And then in the third part, we do cosmology. We'll also do a little bit of black holes, but mostly cosmology. Because in cosmology, there's so much happening these days, so many data, so many new insights. And also this course is in a way a preparation for the course that I will teach next term, which is going to be quantum field theory for cosmology. Now that's going to be cool too, because I don't know if you're all aware of this, but the current standard model of cosmology aims to explain the origin of structure in the universe, including us. You know, why is matter distributed in the way that it is in the universe? And there have been competing theories about this. At the moment, the best theory we have is cosmic inflation. And we will cover next term that theory in great detail. We will prepare the classical side of it, the classical general relativity of it, this term. And next term, it's going to be the quantum theory of it, where then we get to this central mechanism, which is that quantum fluctuations at the very early, in the very early universe, were stretched out to cosmological size and provided the seeds for structure formation later on, which is, if you think about it, just enormous. Right? I think it's one of the most dramatic breakthroughs over the past decades, the insight that the structure in the universe, the distribution of matter, can be directly traced to quantum fluctuations. The statistics matches very accurately. Sure, there are free parameters, there are complaints about the model, but it's the best model we have at the moment. It's pretty cool stuff. Okay, but this course is still going to be classical. Next term, quantum field theory on curved space-time. Okay, so that's about the content. Again, three parts, the math, just a sec, the math, then general relativity, and then cosmology.
Is this one required for the QFT one?
No. In fact, the QFT one will not require much general relativity. And the reason is that all you need to know to do inflationary cosmology from the quantum side is basically FRW spacetimes. You need to know how they behave, what the solutions are, and so on. But you don't really need all of the powerful machinery that we develop in this course. Our course has, on one hand, the aim to prepare for these things. So you will find next term's course pretty easy. But it's also meant to prepare then for studies of quantum gravity, for example, or black hole physics. So it's not just working towards next term's course. So I will admit students next term for the quantum field theory for cosmology course that may just have had an undergrad experience in general relativity. That's possible. So the two courses really are standalone. It's just that they nicely fit one after the other. On this website that you reach from my homepage, clicking on teaching, I will post the lecture notes. The lecture notes I wrote, handwritten. I hope that one day they will be typed up, but I hope they're legible. You'll be the judge of that. And I post those lecture notes always before I teach it. You can, if you wish, then therefore download it earlier, look through them already. But after I teach it, I may change things a little bit. So it helps to sometimes refresh and just load things. In fact, I've taught this course 2 years ago already, and even before, and there are lecture notes from then also available at the bottom of this page. So if you wish, and you're already curious about lecture number 8, yeah, you can do this. It's not guaranteed that this time around it's going to be exactly the same lecture. I try to improve every time I teach it, but roughly you get an impression of what's going on. Also, Craig, who you just saw installing the virus on my computer, I hope he's not listening in and cutting us out now. Craig is recording us. And he usually manages to put the recordings online on Pearsa, Perimeter Institute Recorded Seminar Archive.org, Pearsa.org. He usually manages to put them online the same day, same evening. Which also means that if you, God forbid, catch the flu, for example, in the fall, don't drag yourself in. You don't have to. You know, just get healthy, stay home, and you can always watch it from home as well. And the lecture notes are there too. And if you have any further questions, you can always ask me via email and so on. Okay, so the lecture notes will be posted here, and lecture one is already posted. But again, sometimes I change them a little bit, fix typos and things like that, at least after I teach it. Okay, then there is stuff about essay and project. It's quite a lot of detail. What's expected in the essay, what's expected in the project. Then there's some links to literature here. And then at the very bottom of the page, you find the lecture notes of the previous teaching 2 years ago. And at the very bottom of that, you find also the link to the video recordings of the teachings 2 years ago. So you can always look ahead if you like, and even study ahead if you want to. But on this place here, it'll always be, so much delay. Here it will always be up to date. This year's teaching. Okay. Does anybody have further questions about the logistics? No? Okay, so then let's start. Let's see what we're working with here. It's our universe. Okay, and if we look at this picture, for example, what do we see? What we see is the so-called Hubble Space Telescope. It's a so-called tadpole galaxy, a picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And this tadpole galaxy is actually, this is a crash scene here. See, there used to be a spiral galaxy and another smaller galaxy crashed into it. And then that happened. This galaxy is about 420 million light years away from us. And a galaxy has a typical diameter of, let's say, 100,000 light years, roughly speaking. So you can imagine how big this is in the sky. Because there's a triangle whose length, it has two sides that are 420 million light years, and then it's 100,000 light years there. Right? That's why you don't see that with a naked eye, because it's like thousands of times further away than its size. So it's a very, very small angle in the sky. Okay, so this is about 100,000 light years, roughly. Now, this galaxy is in the foreground. In the background, you see a few stars. Actually, these are further in the foreground. So there are some stars, but then you also see some galaxies there. And these are much smaller. They're not really smaller galaxies. They're just way further away. So they are billions of light years away. Which means, given that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, that we are looking almost halfway through the universe. We're seeing halfway as far as we could possibly see, given that light needs time to travel. So that's what we're working with here. And let's zoom into a region like this of lots of faraway galaxies. And when we look at a picture like that, it looks like this. And what we see here is that we can see curvature directly. We can see that the universe is not flat, but instead it has curvature, which is caused by the presence of matter. In those galaxies, they contain a lot of matter, and the curvature that they produce can act as a lens, as you all know, gravitational lensing. And so you see smudges here, and they are from galaxies even further away that have been lensed by these foreground galaxies. So our universe has curvature in its space-time. And what this course is going to be about is how to model that, how to describe the mathematics of that classically. So we're going to do classical general relativity. But in all we do, I'd like you to keep in mind the question, why? Why do we have to describe it like that? In fact, we can be pretty sure that we don't have to describe it like this. General relativity is, by all probability, not the last word. Quantum gravity is going to be modifying what we know about general relativity. And so when we now, in the first part of this course, study the mathematics that's underlying general relativity, let's keep in mind that what is mathematically true doesn't have to be describing physics. Physics is different from math. In math, you set yourself your axioms, your definitions, and then everything that follows logically is true by definition, because that's how math works, derivation from axioms and definitions. But of course, physics is different. There, the ultimate deciding agent for what is true, what is false, is nature and experiment. And I think it will become pretty clear, if you don't know already, that there are tremendous oversimplifications in the mathematical description that we use for general relativity. Let's just keep that always in mind. Let's always take the math with a grain of salt. It has to be done in a very logically rigorous way. That's the only way you can do math. Otherwise, you run into contradictions. And in case you don't know yet, once you make one mathematical mistake, you can start proving that one is equal to two. So you can really do this. So mathematics has to be super rigorous. But that doesn't mean that the assumptions are true in physics, right? So let's always keep that in mind. I encourage you basically in this course to always ask why. Why do we have to do it like that? What motivates us to make those choices? Okay, so how do we describe space-time? Now we're ready to start the first part of this course, the mathematics part. Remember, the first part is mathematical background, namely differential geometry. The second part is general relativity. The third part is cosmology. So today we start with the mathematical background. And let me give you a quick overview of the three parts. So the A is the math part, B is the general relativity part, C is the cosmology part. So in the math part, we will start today in a very basic way. We will say, we start with a set of points, which will represent in nature events, and then add structure to this set of points so that we get a differentiable manifold. And then we start working with that, describe space-time. And to that end, as you will see in a few minutes, we will start defining what we mean by an open neighborhood, what is a topology, what is separability of points. Then we define what we mean by continuity, what we mean by differentiability. And I hope to explain to you in this what the logical framework here is. And try to see all of these things critically, because probably much of this will not survive the upgrade to quantum gravity eventually. And so, but nobody knows what gives. Nobody knows where in the structure of differential geometry we have to deviate from the current axioms. Okay, so and after we define differentiability, we will define many other things, many kinds of derivatives and integrals, and we define tangent spaces, tensor spaces, and we will define curvature and torsion. Now, the standard way to define curvature is to define curvature as non-triviality of parallel transport. If you parallel transport a vector in some direction and then change direction, and alternatively you start one way and then another way, so that you arrive at the same point, the parallel transport doesn't usually get you back to the same thing, same direction. If, for example, let's say you, just a simple illustration, let's say you stand on the North Pole and you point south, well, you can't help but pointing south if you're standing on the North Pole, and then you walk all the way to the equator, okay, parallel transporting your arm, and then you walk along sideways along the equator for a while, always parallel transporting your arm, and then you walk back up to the North Pole, but you arrive pointing into a different direction. This would never happen on a flat space. So this is one way of defining what curvature is, but it's only one way. It's not clear that this is the way, that this is the best way to understand curvature, keeping in mind that eventually we want to go beyond general relativity and quantize the theory. There are many other ways to think of curvature, and we will cover quite a number of them. For example, the presence of curvature can also be understood as the failure of the sum of the angles of a triangle to be pi. Right? So usually in a triangle, the sum of the angles is 180 degrees. And by usually, I mean on flat space. In a flat plane, a triangle always has the sum of its angles being 180 degrees, but it may not be because of curvature. And you can use this to detect curvature. And in fact, Gauss was the first to actually do an experiment and check whether space is flat or not. He tried that with mountaintops and so on, but his accuracy was, of course, not enough to measure the deviation. And then curvature can also be viewed, the presence of curvature can also be understood as the non-triviality or violations of Pythagoras' law. Right? If a triangle with a right angle in it, a squared plus b squared is equal to c squared, is not true on a curved space. Then curvature can also be understood as the presence of tidal forces. And mathematically speaking, it's the presence of sectional curvatures, as we will see. And then there's another way to understand what curvature is. Imagine you have a piece of pottery, some ceramic vase, for example. And you take a spoon and tap on it. It will make a sound. Now take another piece of pottery, same material, same thickness, but different shape. The sound will be different. So another way to describe curvature is through the sound that the manifold makes when it's excited. Now in space-time, you have fields that can get excited and have eigenmodes. And so you can ask a similar thing. Can I describe space-time curvature through the noise that space-time makes when vibrating? Now you may wonder, well, what spoon will I take to make space-time vibrate? It turns out you don't need a spoon, because the whole thing is quantum. It's always fluctuating. So you can ask, do the quantum fluctuations, does the spectrum, do the correlation functions of the quantum noise, does the sound of the quantum noise tell us about the curvature? And it does. You see, there are very different ways to describe the presence of curvature. And which one is best to lead us to quantum gravity, we don't know. But for example, the approach that I just told you about, the spectral geometry approach, the one with the ceramics, is nice, in my opinion, because it relates the differential geometry of shape to the functional analysis of spectra. Functional analysis being the mathematical language of quantum theory. So it's spectral geometry is a discipline that nicely, naturally, combines the mathematics of quantum theory, of spectra and Hilbert spaces, to the mathematics of general relativity, namely differential geometry and curvature. And there are other ways to think of curvature. For example, the presence of curvature can be viewed as deviations in the usual entanglement structure of quantum fields on space-time. If the space-time is curved, this will affect the entanglement of the vacuum state. We will cover that next time. Okay, so that was the first part. What we will cover in the first part of this course, the mathematics, differential geometry. And then the second part is going to be about general relativity. We will study the equations of motion. And we will study the equations of motion, of course, for scalars, such as the Higgs field, such as the inflaton field, vector fields such as electromagnetism and the weak and the strong force carrying W and Z bosons and the gluons, and then all the spinners such as, you know, all the fermions such as neutrinos and quarks and electrons. And then, of course, we will also cover the equations of motion of curvature itself, which are going to be the Einstein equations. Then, once we have that, we can then study, for example, the symmetries, local symmetries and global symmetries, local conservation laws and global conservation laws. And I assume you know already that energy is not conserved in the universe. And still, sometimes it's a good approximation to assume that it is conserved. You may know already that when there are killing vector fields, you have symmetries and you can have energy conservation. But then there are other circumstances where there are no killing vector fields, and still we would like to have something like energy conservation. For example, let's say two galaxies collide. Then it would be very intuitive if we could say there's a certain potential energy, gravitational potential energy, between the two galaxies. But general relativity doesn't have gravitational potential energy. It's not part of it. It doesn't work like Newtonian gravity. But there is an approximation in which you have something like that. And that's very useful for astrophysics. So we will cover that to some extent as well. Then we will do the tetrad formulation of general relativity, view general relativity as a gauge theory. And we will also look into singularities, singularity theorems that tell us when the formation of a singularity becomes unavoidable. Keep in mind, this is classical general relativity. In the quantum theory, the conditions that, or the assumptions may not hold that lead to the singularity theorem. And we will also talk about horizons. And then thirdly, we will cover applications to cosmology. You all know Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker solutions. But it turns out that there exists a whole family, a big family of solutions, cosmological solutions that go beyond Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker, where you have a little bit less symmetry than these very stringent symmetry assumptions of FRW. And it's very instructive to look into those other solutions as well, because general relativity is a nonlinear theory, and things behave sometimes quite counterintuitively. So we will classify that. We will study models of cosmological matter. You know, for cosmologists, the whole galaxy can be viewed as just a grain of dust. Right? So you can, it's actually a fairly common model where you say that the universe is filled with dust. It has energy density, but it has no pressure. And what are these dust grains? Galaxies. And then we will study cosmic inflation, and to some extent, although it's not going to be the focus of this course, we will look into black holes. Okay, any questions so far? Good. Okay, so we start then with part A of this course. The mathematics of it, differential geometry. And as I said, we start very basic, but then we go pretty quickly. So what we will do is pseudo-Riemannian differential geometry. The pseudo stands for the fact that we allow for Lorentzian signature. The metric doesn't have to be positive definite. So first we need to define what is a differentiable manifold. This concept goes back to Riemann, Poincaré, and Whitney more than 100 years ago. Now I start with a definition where some of you may know all of the terms and some of you may know none of the terms in there, so I'll be very careful and introduce everything. In general, I'm trying to keep this course self-contained. If there's something you don't recognize, just ask me. Either ask in class or ask me later. But don't let not knowing some detail get in the way of understanding things. Okay, so here's a definition that we will pluck apart. We will look at every detail of it. So the definition is that an n-dimensional topological manifold M is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. If we have this, we're almost there. Then we still need to define what we mean by a differentiable manifold. But this gets us the manifold. Okay, so what do we mean by topological manifold, and what do we mean by Hausdorff space, and what does it mean that it's locally homeomorphic to Rn? Let's go through these things one by one. First, we define a topological space. A topological space M is, by definition, any set for which we have defined a set of subsets, which we call open subsets, by definition. And we are justified in calling them open if they have the following property. If you take any two of these subsets, the intersection has to be open. And if you take any number of these subsets, even infinitely many, and take the union, that should also be one of these open sets. So if you have a set M and you define subsets in there, you pick out certain subsets and call them open, and this set of subsets obeys this property that any intersection of them is again one of these open subsets, and any union of them is again one of those that you call open subsets, then you can call your space a topological space. Maybe I should remind you that the word topology has two meanings in mathematics. You may think of topology as having to do with pretzels and donuts and holes in spaces and so on. That's a different use of the word of topology that has basically nothing to do with this use of topology. This use of the word of topology is exactly what is defined here, right? So take it as this. You don't need to have any extra knowledge. This is the starting point. Remember how mathematics is built. Mathematics is built like this. You say that if a set has certain properties, then you call it a XYZ. For example, if a set of elements has the properties of being an abelian group and can also be multiplied with the members of a field, you have a vector space, right? And there are many other definitions you can do. You can say, if I have a set and the elements in there have a binary product, such that you have a Jacobi identity for them, etc. And you see where I'm going, then you call it a Lie algebra, and so on. So in mathematics, that's always how it goes. If you have a set which has operations or properties or whatever, such and such conditions are fulfilled, then you call it a such and such. Right? And that's one of those cases. We are saying, if you have a set and there is a bunch of singled out subsets which are labeled open, obeying these conditions, namely that the intersection is also, you take any one of two, then the intersection of the two also has to be part, also has to be one of the sets that you call open. And also the union of any number of them has to be a set that you is one of those that you call open. If that's true, then you say that you have a topological space. Okay? And just like, just a moment, and just like in the case of vector spaces or Lie algebra, here too, you can have many, many instances of your definition applying, right? So you could have, for example, a five-dimensional vector space. It's a vector space because it obeys the conditions. But you could also have an infinite-dimensional vector space. It's also a vector space because it obeys the definitions. And here too, you can have all sorts of topological spaces. We will be interested in topological spaces that happen to be differentiable manifolds. But the set that we are talking about could be a set of differential equations, right? Or the set that we are talking about could be a set of Lie algebras. Could be a set of anything. If you can single out a bunch of subsets which obey these properties, then your set is also called a topological space, on top of being a set of differential equations, or on top of being a set of Lie algebras or whatever, right? So it's totally general. That's the power of mathematics, that it just goes for the structure of things. Anything that has this structure will be given that name. That's super useful because we prove stuff about the general structures. And so you cover lots of things in one go.
Can you remind me what an intersection of two sets are?
Oh, it's a set of all those points that are in all of them. So,
oh, yeah.
Right? Okay. Okay. So remember, this is completely abstract here, and there's nothing that specifies that this has anything to do with space-time or what we imagine to be something smooth or so. It's just, in fact, you can probably think of, if you think a little bit about it, a set which has, let's say, 12 elements, and then you get to define a bunch of subsets. And you make sure that your bunch of subsets has the property that the intersection and the unions are also subsets of that bunch, then you created yourself a topological space right there. And what you can also see is that given a set, you may be able to put multiple different topologies on it. You can say, oh, this bunch of subsets I call open. Well, if they obey the properties, fine. Then you have a topological space. But you could also choose another bunch of subsets if they obey this property. And then you have another topological structure on the same set. All right, so now we have topological spaces. And when do we call a topological space Hausdorff? Remember, this Hausdorff thing came also up in the definition up there. Well, topological space is called Hausdorff if it is what is called separable, which is to say that if we have two different points of our set M, so if x is not equal to y, then there exist open sets of which they are members that do not that have no intersection. So intuitively means if you choose any two points, x and y, you will find a neighborhood. You will find an open set that contains x and an open set that contains y with the property that they have a zero intersection. There's no overlap between the two sets ux and uy. OK, so in this case, we have that it's separable, or Hausdorff. And here I wrote the same statement in purely mathematical language. So, you know, this upside down A means for all, and this left, right, reversed E means there exists. So for all x, y, for which it is true that x is not equal to y, there exists a ux and a ui open such that x is in ux, y is in ui, and the intersection of the two open sets is n. Okay? This was just a little reminder of mathematical notation, because sometimes to save space on the slide, I will use that way of writing things. So for example, what would be a topological space that is Hausdorff? Well, Rn, for example, with the usual definition of open sets. I can take a sphere without its boundary, a ball without the boundary sphere. OK, now, another word that came up in this definition was homeomorphic. Now, how is homeomorphic defined? Let me just go back to the definition to remind you there. So we said an n-dimensional topological manifold M is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. Okay, so this is something that we also need on the way to defining differentiable manifolds. Okay. So we know that Rn is a topological space, and it's Hausdorff too, because for any two points in Rn, we can find an open neighborhood for any two points, we can find two open neighborhoods that contain these two points, but that don't overlap. So how do we define homeomorphic? For this, in order to define the notion of homeomorphic, we need to define what continuity means. Now, everybody in this audience has probably already a clear idea what continuity means, right? It means the function doesn't do jumps, right? But it turns out that there's a much more general definition of this. After all, we are not always dealing with a function from Rn into Rm where we can think of a jump or a cliff or something like this. Sometimes we may want to map from a space of differential equations into a space of Lie algebras. Well, then what does continuity mean? Right? So what is the true definition of continuity? Well, some of you may have seen this before, so I'm writing recall. So imagine A and B are topological spaces. Remember what that means? It means there's a set where we've singled out a bunch of open sets, open subsets, which have this property of intersection and union and so on. So imagine A and B are both topological spaces, meaning that we know what we mean by open subsets here. We know which are the open subsets over there. So imagine we have two of these sets, A and B, topological spaces. And imagine we have some map from this topological space into that topological space, where, as I said, A might be a manifold eventually, but A, for all we know, could be a bunch of non-commutative groups or whatever, as long as it's a topological space. So you have a map from some topological space into another topological space. When is this map called continuous? Well, it is called, by definition, it is called continuous if, when we take an open subset of B, so U contained in B is open, this must imply that the pre-image of that U is also open, is open now in A. The pre-image is the set of all points that map into U. Okay, so the pre-image F inverse of U is the set of all X in the first topological space, which map into U, the subset, open subset in here. So if the pre-image of every open set is an open set, then it's called continuous. That may sound a little weird, but it shouldn't be. Let's look at the case that we all understand. Here's a function from R into R. Okay, so f of x is just mapping. It's just here, I'm plotting the graph of our function f of x. And this function f of x is intuitively not continuous, right? So what does it do? It goes like this, and then at the value 3, it takes some value, and then it jumps, and then for any value larger than 3, for any x larger than 3, it continues like this. So the jump, strictly speaking, means here we have a point at the end, here we don't. Okay? So now let's look at whether this is continuous according to that definition. So we have our function f from R into R, it's just like from A into B, from R into R. Now we choose an open set. Okay, we choose an open set, for example, in the image, that's the y-axis here, the open set from 1 to 3. So this is the set of all points between 1 and 3, excluding 1, excluding 3, because we want it to be open. Then if our function were continuous, u, this interval from 1 to 3 being open, would have to imply that the pre-image of the interval from 1 to 3 is also open in here. But let's look what the set of points is that map into the interval from 1 to 3. Well, it's the set of points from 1.5 to 3. Okay? Excluding 1.5, because we are excluding 1, right? This interval is open from 1 to 3. So it's 1 is excluded, 3 is excluded. So we go over here. So 1.5 is excluded, but all those points here map into values between 1 and, well, between 1 and 2, actually. So all the points between 1.5, excluding 1.5, and including 3 map into this interval, which means that the pre-image is actually the interval which is open on the left, 1.5, but closed on the right. Which means that this pre-image is not an open set because it includes the 3 because of this jump. Okay. But the great thing about this is that we didn't have to take any limits here. Right? This was not the usual calculus definition of what is continuous here. We just talked about open sets and whether a set is open or not. So you can do this analysis of continuity for the cases that we know, and you will recover that functions are called continuous or not continuous according to what we usually consider to be continuous or not continuous. But remember that A and B could be, you know, non-abelian groups and whatever, categories or whatever. And you map between them, as long as you have topological spaces here, as long as you know what are the open subsets, you can check whether or not a map is continuous. So it's pretty powerful stuff. All right, so now we have defined continuity. What we are really aiming for was what is homeomorphic. Homeomorphic means that there exists a continuous map between two things. A is homeomorphic to B if there's a continuous map. All right, I was just anticipating here. So I wanted to make the remark that this is a powerful definition that can be applied very generally, much beyond differential geometry. Why is it important for us here? Well, it's important for us here because we can now express the idea that a topological Hausdorff space, M, is continuously parameterizable, as space-time appears to be. Right? Space-time, so far, we had in mind, space-time consists of events. They will be the points. They will be the elements of our topological space. But we know from experimental experience that the points of space-time can be labeled. We can give them coordinates. Right? And that property we think of when we say that space-time is continuous rather than a discrete lattice. So now we are trying to make that accurate. When we say we think of space-time as being a continuous manifold, what exactly do we mean by continuity? Now we have defined what continuity is. Okay? So we look at the set of space-time events, and we define open sets in there. But now we want to define, we also want to express mathematically the idea that this is more than that. It can also be continuously parameterized. So the definition is, you remember, I didn't have that on the board before. Okay, so M is called locally homeomorphic to Rn. If each point P of our M, which is later going to be the space-time manifold, but for now it's just a topological Hausdorff space, M is called locally homeomorphic to Rn if each point P has a neighborhood U of P, an open neighborhood, and an invertible continuous map from our open neighborhood into Rn. So Rn, we know, Rn we are familiar with. And so what we are saying is that M, our topological space, is called, we say that it is homeomorphic to Rn if there exists a continuous and invertible map from any neighborhood of any point into Rn, or into a subset of Rn. So remember, we defined what it means to have a continuous map. Topological space here, topological space there. Then the pre-images of open sets have to be open. That's what it means to have continuity. Here, what are the two topological spaces? Well, here, it's the neighborhood of a point in our manifold, and Rn. Both are topological spaces. Here we know what the open sets are. Here we still have to we still have to define them. We still have to make them up. But we know what it means that we have continuity, that we have, these are going to be the coordinates, right? So here we have events, and here we have coordinates. So we have these two topological spaces, and for any open set in here, the pre-image in there also needs to be open. That's what we mean by continuity. Okay, so finally, we got all the ingredients for that definition that I had on the board earlier. Namely, the definition was that an n-dimensional topological manifold M is a Hausdorff space, which is a topological space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. Okay, so we have a topology on M. M is any set that has a topology that is Hausdorff. So for any two points, there exist local neighborhoods that don't intersect. And there's got to be a continuous map into Rn, at least locally for patches. Patches of M into patches of Rn. Okay, so far we have topology wrapped up. But we want differentiability. Now here we will find something cool and rather unexpected. So now we are after the following notion. When is a manifold, our M, when is it differentiable? Now of course we have in mind that it's similar to functions, right? So when we take a function, then we can check, is it once differentiable, is it twice differentiable, is it seven times differentiable, and at some point it might fail and it's no longer differentiable, right? So we might think that for manifolds it's the same thing. It's not. There's something very cool happening for manifolds that we will see today. For a function, if it is once differentiable, once continuously differentiable, there's no guarantee that it's twice continuously differentiable. For manifolds, there is. If it's once continuously differentiable, it's arbitrarily many times continuously differentiable. Weird, I know. But we'll see how that comes about. For that, we have to keep in mind that differentiability for a manifold is defined somewhat differently than it is for functions. But we will induce it from the differentiability of functions that we already know. We know what it means for a function from Rn into Rm to be differentiable. That knowledge we will use to define what we mean by differentiability of a manifold. Okay, so that's the last step that we will do today. So how is a differentiable manifold defined? So, what is a local homeomorphism? Remember, we just defined it. It means it's a map from a patch of our M, our manifold M, into Rn, which is homeomorphic, which means it's continuous and invertible. And we give this a name now. We say that such a local homomorphism is called a chart, or coordinate system, if you like. Yes, because it will map the events or the points of our manifold M into points in Rn. Super important, because this abstract manifold doesn't, it contains all those events, all those points in it, but they don't have labels yet. Of course, we could pick one label out and call it Peter, right? And then we could pick out one event and call it Peter, and then we pick another event and call it Bob, but that wouldn't be very efficient. We have to come up with names for every event. So what we do is we define a map from the manifold into Rn. And then suddenly all the events have names, namely these tuples of numbers there. And we want this to be continuous. And we now know what we mean by continuity. It's that we have that this is a topological space, that's a topological space, and the pre-images of all these open sets have to be open sets over there. All right, so whenever we map a patch of the manifold into a patch of Rn in a continuous fashion, this is what is called a chart. And then, for any point in the manifold, for any Q in the manifold, its image, so the chart is called H here, remember the chart is H, it maps the events into their coordinates. this vector in Rn, which will have components from x1 to xn, are called the coordinates of this point. But really, these coordinates are simply names instead of calling these events Peter and Bob and whatever. We give them these names. Okay, now the patch on which such a chart is defined is called the domain. And visually, it looks like this. Our manifold we can think of as being this bigger thing here, and then we have a patch in there on which we have a local chart. So all the events in here, all the elements of the manifold in here, are being mapped in a continuous fashion into some piece of Rn. Maybe all of Rn, maybe just a piece of it. So this is called a local coordinate system for U. Actually, let me try this. Okay, so this is then, so this H is a local coordinate system. It's a machine that produces names for events. Now, of course, one chart is not going to be enough. So we collect many charts, such that the union of all these charts, such that the union of the domains of all these charts covers the manifold. And then we call this an atlas. An atlas is, of course, a collection of maps. And so if we have a collection of charts, you know, H maps this patch into Rn, and then there might be another patch, and another patch, and another patch, each with their own maps over to Rn, right? And what we want, of course, is that the manifold is covered, and so we are looking for a bunch of charts that such that the union of their domains, if alpha is a chart, then U alpha is the domain of that chart, and the union of all these charts should be the manifold itself. Now, what if we want to change coordinates? That is, if we want to relabel the points. So for example, we might have just renaming them, right? Because all these Rn tuples are just names for the events. But different charts give them different names. What if we want to do that for a subset of the manifold? This looks intuitively like this. Here we have the entire manifold again. And now we have one patch of the manifold, and all those events, all those points of the manifold in here, are being mapped by the chart H1 in a continuous way into Rn, a subset of Rn. But we also have a chart H2. And that chart H2 is mapping this patch in a continuous way into Rn. And you notice here's the intersection of the two sets. These points have two names. Each point in here is given a name in this coordinate system, that is to say with this map, but it also has a name in Rn, and by name I mean just an n-tuple of numbers, using this map. So all of those points have really, these points I can look at in each coordinate system. And you see, we can now also see what it means to change coordinate system. To change coordinate system means, let's say I have this point here. It has some coordinates according to that map, and some coordinates according to that map. And in order to get the transformation from these coordinates to those coordinates, I have to invert this chart and then go forward with that chart. That's what a coordinate change does. So for H1 and H2 being two charts, we can take H1 inverse, so it's literally the inverse map, mapping points in Rn into points of the manifold. And then afterwards, we apply H2. If you haven't seen that before, this little circle is usually the symbol that we use to concatenate maps. So the output of this map feeds as the input into this map. The concatenation symbol is this little circle. Okay, so we take H1 inverse, which takes input from here, output there. And then, of course, it has to be one of the points in the intersection. And then we can apply H2 to get over here. So H12 is mapping the intersection of U1 and U2. Oh, sorry, it's mapping a patch of Rn into this intersection into a patch of Rn. So that's the change of coordinate. Now, I'm mentioning these changes of coordinates for two reasons. One reason is that, obviously, we're going to make use of these sorts of things. Changes of coordinates are daily exercises, right? But more than that, you see, we defined what we mean by the continuity of a map from here to there. And it was quite a struggle to do this. Because we had to define what is the topology, what makes it Hausdorff, and what are open sets. And you know, then continuity was defined as the case where the pre-image of open sets is open, and so on. And then homeomorphic meant that, yeah. All of that was necessary just to say what it means that this is continuous. Now that we have changes of coordinates, we have the changes of coordinates are maps from Rn into Rn, right? So H12, this map, is a map from Rn into Rn. But for maps from Rn into Rn, we know what differentiability means. So we can use this now to define what we mean by a manifold being differentiable. Okay, so for maps from Rn into Rn, we know what differentiability means. So the strategy now is to define differentiability of an atlas being a bunch of charts which together cover the manifold. So we define the differentiability of an atlas through the differentiability of its chart changes. By the way, differentiability is a word that has way too many syllables. And so sometimes I will just write diffability. Diffability. Kind of unique, right? I mean, it can't be anything else that what's meant here. It's got to be differentiability. Okay. So an atlas, a bunch of charts, bunch of coordinate maps, right? Coordinate systems. An atlas is called CR differentiable. So R times continuously differentiable. If all of its coordinate changes H alpha beta, where alpha is some charge and beta is some charge. If all of its coordinate changes are CR diffeomorphisms. Now we do know what it means for these maps from here, being from Rn to Rn. We know what it means that it's five times continuously differentiable, that it is a diffeomorphism of CR kind, right? So we say that an atlas is CR differentiable if all of its coordinate changes are CR diffeomorphisms, that is R times continuously differentiable. So we enlarge now the atlas so that every point in M is in multiple charts, so that we have every point in M, we have the ability to go from one coordinate system through the point to another coordinate system. So we make sure that our atlas is big enough so that every point is in multiple charts. Then the differentiability of M, the differentiability of the manifold, can be defined through the differentiability of the atlas, meaning that all of the coordinate changes are differentiable maps. And then we then given a CR differentiable atlas A, we generate a maximal CR differentiable atlas by adding all charts whose chart changes with charts that are already in A are differentiable. So this is, of course, an unwieldily large set. But as a matter of principle, we can define that. So basically, we add all possible coordinate systems that are related to the ones that we already have differentiably. Then when we have such a complete atlas, then we call this a differentiable structure of class CR for our manifold. If all of the coordinate changes are CR differentiable. Then the definition is, of course, that the differentiable manifold of class CR, continuously differentiable R times, is a topological manifold, you know, according to the definitions above, with a maximal atlas of class CR, that is to say, with a differentiable structure of class CR. So it has coordinate systems that cover everything and that are differentiably related to each other, R times differentiable. And then the last thing we cover today is a theorem by Whitney, which is that every k times differentiable structure for k larger or equal to 1 is actually equivalent to a C infinity structure. So there always exists a suitable set of charts of coordinate systems which are much more differentiable. Now that's pretty cool, because what it means is that any differentiable structure can be smoothed if the coordinate changes are once continuously differentiable. Then you can find new coordinate changes which will be arbitrarily many times continuously differentiable, which is to say that any lack of higher differentiability, if you find that your coordinate change is only five times continuously differentiable, then it means, well, you've just chosen unlucky coordinates. You could have chosen better coordinates, such that the change of coordinates would have been arbitrarily many times differentiable. Therefore, since any C1, once continuously differentiable manifold, is also C infinity differentiable manifold, we simply call differentiable manifolds smooth manifolds. You know, smooth is often used as shortcut for saying that it's C infinity. All right, so what we've done today is introduced the basics of differentiable manifolds. And this lecture today was not typical of the rest of the course. In case you love analysis, you might have liked this. But my point was not to introduce in great detail here exactly how, you know, a topological space is defined and, you know, Hausdorff conditions and so on. It was important that you've seen this. But perhaps more important is that you keep in mind how little physics is in this. This is how mathematicians have envisaged for more than 100 years what Rn is and generalized that, right? There's very little physical input in this. And it's quite unlikely that space-time really is described by this. How do we know, for example, that space-time is Hausdorff? That for any two events, there's an open neighborhood that contains them that has no intersection. How do we know that? It would require us knowing the structure of space-time at 10 to the minus a million meters. We don't know that. Right? We don't know that. We don't even know how space-time looks like at scales smaller than 10 to the minus 20 meters. 10 to the minus 20 meters is what you can probe if you have a telescope that, not telescope, microscope. If you have a, it's cosmology, right? If you have a microscope that uses light with the energy of one TeV, tera electron volt, the kind of energy that CERN uses at the LHC, then you can test with your microscope structures of size 10 to the minus 20 meters. That's about as far as we can drill down. So basically, we know, for example, that an electron is point-like to the extent that we know it's at most as big as 10 to the minus 20 meters. But what happens at smaller distances, we don't know. We have no way of probing it yet. But this, of course, assumes that space-time is the same kind of thing arbitrarily small now, right? The Planck scale is at 10 to the minus 35 meters, which is 15 orders of magnitude more than 10 to the minus 20 meters. So we are 15 orders of magnitude away, and it might cost 15 orders of magnitude more money to actually build an accelerator that would prove that would probe distances as small as that. But this makes the assumption that space-time is like Rn down to arbitrarily small scales, like 10 to the minus a million meters. There's no way that this is correct. But what gives? I wanted to show you the edifice on which the whole thing is built, because maybe one of you one day will figure out what gives. You know, how do we go beyond that? This is very successful for almost all of cosmology. But when it comes to studying the beginning of the universe or quantum gravity physics in general, then probably this is pretty wrong. But only in these extreme circumstances, right? So keep in mind that these things have their origin in mathematics, inspired by physics, but not inspired by quantum theory. And that still needs to be done. OK, questions so far? We have like 3 minutes. Any logistical questions? Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's just maybe it's in terms of your definition of local polymorphism. So you're saying that the function has to be continuous and invertible, but shouldn't you also require that the inverse is continuous?
We are requiring that the concatenation of the inverse and the forward of the two charts is even more, namely that it's differentiable.
Yeah, but like for the inverse itself, also be continuous.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, but make it precise for the purpose of.
Sorry, do you mean for the purpose of?
Well, okay. So if you have a requirement, and then you require this in order to define or
to define the fine line, but so it's for the composition.
Okay, so are you saying that there could be cases where the inverse is not continuous? But the concatenation with the forward map of the other chart turns out to be differentiable.
Yeah, basically. But I guess if you don't define, like if you just require the differentiability between Rn and Rn, it could still work even without the topology and the manifold, and you could define the topology after the differentiability.
I didn't get the last point. So you're saying when you have the differentiability from Rn to Rn, then?
I think I saw something that when you have something, you just have maps, you don't require any topology on your manifold. And then you just require that the composition of the maps between Rn and the manifold and manifolds in Rn are differentiable, like what you said, basically.
Yes.
And then I think you can put a topology on the manifold with that, which would avoid this discussion.
This might be possible, yes. But I still need to be convinced that there is a case where the inverse is not continuous, but the concatenation of a non-continuous map with a continuous map would give you a differentiable map. I think that would be interesting to check. I don't know by heart. I would not think it's possible, but
so if you take the zero map, it's possible, but it's not a bijection. So
yeah, it would be required to be bijection.
That might be.
Yeah. Well, if you find an example, yes, by all means, let me know. Yeah. Okay. Good. Keep challenging. Good. Yes.
What do we mean by an open set?
Okay. When we defined a topology, then on purpose, I didn't tell you what an open set is in the sense of, you know, like it's an epsilon neighborhood and it's not the equality just smaller equal to the distance and whatnot, right? That's what how you might want to do it for R or Rn. No, the definition was basic. It was not referring to anything else. It was defining openness on the spot, not referring to anything else, right? It was not relying on anything else. So if you have a set and you single out a set of subsets in such a way that they have the property that any finite intersection gives you a subset which is in your bunch of subsets that you singled out, and also any finite union, any union of these subsets gives you a subset that is in the set that you singled out, then you're justified in calling your subsets open. Remember, that's important. Yeah. You see, you can define a topology as arising, for example, from a metric. When you have a distance notion of distance, then you can often induce a topology from that. And we do that in quantum mechanics all the time when we have a Hilbert space, for example. Wow. Okay. Was that the virus that Craig installed? Right. Yeah.
I thought you were using open and close in your example for your definition of continuity.
Oh, in the example, yes.
That was different.
Oh, yeah. The example was just relying for that moment, just for that map that obviously had a step in it.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I was just relying on your pre-existing knowledge of open and closed sets and so on and functions. And I just wanted to illustrate that it matches in this case. But the definition itself was much more general.
But this set, are these discrete or they continue?
You have to define, well, we defined what continuous means, right? But it's a good point. You can take a set of 10 elements and put a topology on it, and you would probably not call this continuous, and it wouldn't obey.
At what point, well, before we introduce our charts, how do we know what is the, I guess, appropriate Rn to choose? What's the smallest value of n that works?
Well, it has to be bijective, and that will fix it.
Okay, so what kind of, is it the set itself or the topology that we choose for it that kind of decides how big R or how big N needs to be?
It kind of works the other way around. You see, think of it this way. Let's say we look at a five-dimensional vector space. Then in principle, it consists of a bunch of points of which we know that we have an abstract way of adding them and multiplying them with, let's say, real or complex numbers. But we can't work with it in this way. So what we do is we define a basis and then we have coordinates. So basically we map our abstract five-dimensional vector space into something very concrete that we can then work with. And that's super important because the abstract thing is just not something that we can conveniently work with. And for differentiable manifolds, it's very similar. How on earth are we describing this differential manifold? We do it by mapping it using those charts into Rn. And so we are inducing the manifold that we are describing through its charts, through the way we actually write it down. Just like we may think of an abstract vector, but we're not going to be able to pinpoint it until we've chosen some bases and given coordinates, given coefficients in that basis. And so similarly with a manifold, we can't really work with it until we have some map into Rn, or preferably even multiple charts and so on. So there is no starting point of the manifold that would describe it in a manageable way without having a chart. Sometimes you can, to some extent. Let's say you can have a manifold of solutions to some set of differential equations. And then you can prove certain things about it without ever parameterizing it, without ever choosing a chart of it. But generally, you need a chart to actually work with it. It's a bit like in quantum mechanics, where you always need to find the basis, and then you work in the position representation, momentum representation, whatever, even though what's really going on is, of course, abstract and independent of any choice of basis. This will be a central theme, actually, throughout the course, that we will want to free ourselves from arbitrary choices of coordinate systems, arbitrary choices of bases. So for example, much emphasis is placed in first courses on general relativity, usually on changes of coordinates. And we would say things like, yeah, but you can describe the same thing in completely different coordinates. Now, what is often overlooked is that what we do in introductory courses to general relativity is usually that we choose bases for the tangent and cotangent spaces that are tied to the choice of coordinate system. And that need not be so. It's very important that we can choose not only the coordinates freely, we can also choose the bases in our tangent and cotangent spaces and in tensor spaces completely freely. This will lead us to general relativity as a gauge theory. And just generally, it will allow us to view the structure of general relativity independently of any human choices, coordinate systems or bases. For example, it's usually thought in physics that you can recognize a tangent vector by its transformation properties under changes of coordinates. Strictly speaking, that's nonsense. Right? Because just because you're changing coordinates, why would that change the basis in your tangent space? It doesn't have to. Right? Because a tangent vector to a point is, it has certain coefficients. And if you change your coordinate systems, it's the same vector still. If you keep the basis, its coefficients don't change. It's because we usually, without spelling it out, change bases in the tangent spaces as we change coordinates. That's the only reason why the coefficients of vectors change when we change coordinate system. But it's not necessary. And it frees us up if we recognize that and see how we can handle this, how we can change coordinate systems independently of changing bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, for example. It's, for example, going to be important when we write down the Dirac equation on curved space-time. Because for spinners, it would be a headache if we always had to transform them as we change the coordinates, as we would see. Any further questions? All right, so in this course, we are going to do very different things. So today, it was quite, abstract mathematical. Sometimes it will be very physical. Sometimes it will be all about differential equations. Sometimes it will be all about the physics of things. So it will be quite different from lecture to lecture. Sometimes it will be more to the liking of one sort of people, and then the others like the other time better. I hope it's going to be a colorful mix for everybody. Okay, see you on Monday.